Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin in Penang with your twice-weekly wake-up call. Well, you probably don't associate the government with destroying jobs, although there is a trend towards getting rid of small businesses and handing over the spoils to big business. So, today, I'm going to share with you the horrific experience of a well-meaning individual who wanted to open a restaurant in Nevada. It goes like this. For many years, many of my friends and family who have come to my home and experienced my cooking have told me that I should, quote-unquote, open a restaurant. Of course, I took this with a grain of salt, since many people say this exact phrase to many other people. There's a lot of people who are able to create very delicious meals. About 5 years ago, there was a restaurant for sale not too far from my home and business. I thought about buying the restaurant, but at that time the economy was not doing well, and I wanted to take a wait-and-see attitude before I committed to anything. Eventually, the restaurant closed down, and a different type of business opened up in the space that had been a restaurant. That business went under in the middle of 2014, and I decided it might be time to open a retail food establishment in the space that used to be a restaurant. How hard could it be? I signed a lease with the property owner for his 1,000 square foot space. I contracted with a general contractor and designed the restaurant floor space on a CAD program that I have on my office machine. Having bootstrapped 2 7-figure companies from the ground up over the past 25 years, I knew all of the permits needed in order to open a regular business. First, I had to have my attorney file for incorporation in my state. Then, I secured my FEIN, or Federal Employer Identification Number, from the IRS, opened a bank account, got my sales and use tax permit to collect sales taxes from the state, and contacted the person at the state level who is responsible for food establishments at the state level. The department that handles such things is the Nevada Health Department. The inspector who is responsible for my geographic area, since I live in a sparsely populated county, we don't have a county health department, at the state level told me that since the space had not been a restaurant for a few years, I would need to pay additional fees the first year, and my endeavour would be treated as a new retail food establishment. The cost was an additional $500, but that's just the way it is. The property already had a grease interceptor, 1,500 gallons, floor drains, a mop sink, air exchanger on the roof, and was mostly plumbed. I'll get back to this later. I submitted the plans to the state contact person and was told that my symbology was not standard for the plumbing and electrical. The suggestion was made that I seek the services of an architect. Very well, I did. I found an architect who has done some restaurants in the area, and we got to work. I submitted my floor plan to him, which he said was very detailed and seemed to use the space to its maximum potential. However, he did mention that if I were going to serve one single person as a dine-in customer, I would have to have at least one ADA-compliant bathroom. The space had 2 existing bathrooms that were ADA, but not the latest version. So those would have to be upgraded. Next, he told me that if I served in-house, I would need to provide 2 ADA-compliant bathrooms. I was going to remove one of the ADA bathrooms so I could have more seating, but if I had more seating, I would need 2 bathrooms. Catch 22. My architect submitted to the state for review and was told that I would need to expand the hallway. That means that the current hallway walls would need to be completely gutted with plumbing removed and drains moved. I guess it really didn't matter, though, since according to the state of Nevada, I was required to have 8 sinks in my 1,000-square-foot space. I needed 2 bathroom sinks, which I had, 1 dirty sink with 3 wells, clearly labelled Wash, Rinse, Sanitize. This sink needed to have 2 sideboards of not less than 18 inches, etc. I also had to have 1 prep sink with a wand faucet, 1 dedicated mop sink, 2 hand wash stations that could not be near any other sinks, and a bar sink for smoothies. This meant I had to have an extra floor drain put in while the others needed to be moved. Great. 8 sinks. Cost to bring the plumbing to code and provide engineered drawings and system? $20,000 to $25,000. After 6 revisions to the plans, to make the state happy, I finally gave the plans to a general contractor. He sent it to his electrical and plumbing subcontractors. They informed the general that due to code issues, they would have to quote an engineered HVAC system that provided balanced air for the replacement needed by the hood exhaust. The hood exhaust would need to be tied into the HVAC so that my customers would be in an environment that met the state standards for air quality. Okay. The plumber also said that I needed a brand new engineered waste pipe system, one that could only be installed by jackhammering the entire plumbing system, since the state was requiring a detailed drawing of the pipes in the floor, since it was put in before they had these requirements. They would want it all dug up and put into a plan. Great. Engineered HVAC cost? $40,000. Even though the place seemed to work fine for 25 years with an evaporative cooler and a gas heater. Next, I was told that since I would need a 200-amp electrical service panel, which I knew, the power company would have to replace the transformer on the pole outside, since new construction requires new EPA-compliant transformers. The buildings are 30 years old, but hey, it's a restaurant. The power company fee alone would be $12,000 to $15,000. Cost to upgrade electrical to code? $20,000, including power company costs to install EPA-approved transformer. Next, I was told that I would have to have the gas pipe dug up, jackhammered, and replaced with a larger diameter gas line. This would be $20,000 or so. The reason is, of course, that the new code requires a minimum pipe diameter for gas, even though I was only going to have 1 appliance on gas, the range. Everything else is electric. Keep in mind that all of this was taking time. In point of fact, from the time I signed the lease in late December until just this past week, I was doing nothing but getting my paperwork ready and trying to comply with government mandates. Essentially, I spent 7 months trying to not only figure out what I needed to do while I was paying rent and utilities, but I also spent many hours trying to figure out the complexities of what the state required. For instance, each food establishment is required to have at least one food service handling manager. Each person who serves or prepares food has to take a food handler course. The manager course is about $500 when all is said and done. The food handler course is about half that. This is an annual fee. Aside from what I was being required to do for the construction, the state also required the following: a complete list of vendors. Said vendors must be USDA certified wholesale food suppliers. No, farmers markets, supermarket, or homegrown. A complete menu listing calories of each ready-made product. A sample of my labels for prepackaged product showing nutritional data, ingredients, warnings about any allergens, peanut, etc. My estimate of how many employees I thought I would need, so they can tax me on each employee annually, something the county does too. Certificates for any employees who would be handling food, including any managers. My federal EIN and my state tax ID. Complete plans, contractors, amount of estimated business, so they can pre-tax me on estimated sales taxes. It just goes on and on. The law in Nevada is called the Nevada Revised Statutes, or NRS. The statutes for retail food are about 500 pages thick. That's just the codes that cover food. This does not cover the building, electrical, plumbing, and service codes, such as ADA compliance, handicap parking, etc. So I quit. They beat me. It always amazes me when politicians use the soundbite of how they will create jobs. Well, I'm an entrepreneur and have created thousands of jobs over the past 25 years. I have also been responsible for over 500 million in savings to my customers over that time period. This means that $500 million of wealth that was saved could be put into new technologies, new business ventures, for into savings. End of story. Not much I can add to that, really, is there? You know, when you think of eager immigrants such as those who came to the United States in the past to seek fame and fortune, you have to wonder what incentives exist today to encourage more to come. I'm afraid this particular version of a wake-up call requires you to believe that people should actually be headed the other way. All right. Well, the junk bond market lost money in July after having already lost money in June. It was the third losing month so far this year, despite their high coupon payments that make these bonds look so juicy to yield desperate fund managers. The Fed hasn't even raised interests yet. And the riskiest junk bonds, rated CCC or below, have plunged in value, and where average yields have soared from a ludicrous low of 8% a year ago to over 13% now. That rout is far from over. No matter how terrible and obvious the risks, fund managers, driven to near insanity by the Fed's zero interest rate policy, held their noses and closed their eyes and picked up the worst junk, thus continuing to fund over-leveraged, money-losing, cash-flow-negative companies that should have been restructured or liquidated years ago. These investors provided the new money that kept the charade going and bailed out the old money. Energy companies are at the centre, but it's spreading beyond them. And all this debt on their balance sheets is now coming home to roost under the supervision of the courts. Already, corporate Chapter 11 bankruptcy filings in July have soared 77% year over year to 637 filings, the most in nearly 3 years. And that's from the Wall Street Journal, based on data from Epic Systems. Well, over the past year, productivity has increased just 0.3% and a mere 0.5% over the past 5 years, during which the economy has struggled to escape the clutches of the financial crisis and the recession that supposedly ended in mid-2009. The result has been growth in job creation, but little corresponding rise in wages and, subsequently, living standards. It's essentially been the economy's dirty little secret, even as Wall Street forecasters continue to project breakout growth that never seems to come. And you have to remember that the jobs figures are a giant fraud. Three people that stop by to wash dishes for a restaurant for a couple of hours a day, 3 days a week, accounted as three jobs. Three people, essentially unemployed, counted as employed workers. How ridiculous is that? More and more people are now fearful that the coming decline will be worse than 2008-2009. Of course it will be. You all know that. But it still comes as a surprise to most people. The amount of exposure to derivatives the top five US banks have today is 45% larger than it was just before the collapse in 2008. The very same people who created the 2008 banking crisis are at it again, having created another, much bigger derivatives bubble. $273 trillion versus $187 trillion in 2008. The FDIC Commission has enough money in its insurance fund to cover just 1.01% of all the money in US bank accounts, or about $1 for every $100 of your money. According to Global Finance Magazine's annual list of the 50 safest banks in the world, only five are US-based, and the highest rank of any of those five is number 39. And as I said to you last week, Gallup CEO and Chairman Jim Clifton just revealed that for the first time in 35 years, American business deaths now outnumber business births. I don't need to tell you what all this means, do I? The federal government ran a budget deficit of $149 billion in July. The shortfall was $55 billion higher than last July. In July, the government spent $375 billion, up $66 billion, or 21% from last July. Some of the biggest spending increases were for Medicare and education programs. For the fiscal year to date, the deficit is $466 billion compared to $460 billion for the same period a year ago. More working-age people than ever before are not working. More people than ever before are on the government dole. Welfare pays more than most jobs. Retirement funds have been cashed out and spent on living expenses. U.S. mortgage holders are carrying the most non-mortgage debt they've had in more than 10 years. 81% of that is automobile debt. Student loan debt held by mortgage holders is the highest it's ever been, with the average balance owed at nearly $35,000. Okay, well, just so you know, Mexico's richest man and the world's second richest man, Carlos Slim, has recently lost about $7.2 billion, or a tenth of his net worth, as various of his diversified investments have hit the skids. The only reason I bring this to your attention is that I have always said that the coming downturn will hit the very rich extremely hard, and many will lose everything. Remember, rich people only derive their wealth through the economies they control, and if the world spirals into depression, they cannot possibly be spared. In the end, most of the wealth of these billionaire financiers is to be found in leveraged paper with very little tangible wealth backing it. If an investment is leveraged 20 times and it loses over 5% of its value, it's already underwater. Leverage is great when the economy keeps expanding. When it contracts, the losses cannot be paid. And that's why people fear deflation. Okay, well, the number of people living in high poverty areas, that's defined as census tracts where 40% or more of families have income levels below the federal poverty threshold, nearly doubled between 2000 and 2013 to 13.8 million from 7.2 million, according to a new analysis of census data by Paul Jargowski, a public policy professor at Rutgers University, Camden, and a fellow at the Century Foundation. That's the highest number of Americans living in high-poverty neighborhoods ever recorded. The development is worrying, especially since the number of people living in high-poverty areas fell 25% to 7.2 million from 9.6 million, between 1990 and 2000. Back then, concentrated poverty was declining in part because the economy was booming. Don't let the misleading economic numbers fool you. As Paul Craig Roberts has pointed out, if honest numbers were being used, our current unemployment rate would not be too far away from the unemployment rate at the height of the Great Depression. In 1994, the Clinton regime stopped counting long-term discouraged workers as unemployed. Clinton wanted his economy to look better than Reagan's, so he ceased counting the long-term discouraged workers that were part of Reagan's unemployment rate. John Williams of shadowstats.com continues to measure the long-term discouraged with the official methodology of that time, and when these unemployed are included, the US rate of unemployment as of July 2015 is 23%, several times higher than during the recession with which Fed Chairman Paul Volcker greeted the Reagan presidency. An unemployment rate of 23% gives economic recovery a new meaning. It has been 85 years since the Great Depression, and the US economy is in economic recovery with an unemployment rate close to that of the Great Depression. But instead of telling us the truth, the mainstream media continues to put out lots of happy stories. Well, earlier this week we found out that the US Environmental Protection Agency caused a massive spill of more than 10 million liters of toxic chemicals into the Animas River in Colorado. At first, the EPA admitted to about 3 million litres. But now another government agency with better data is saying, in fact, that it's over 10 million litres. The river flows into New Mexico and Arizona, where it eventually joins Lake Powell, a major source of drinking water for Las Vegas, San Diego, and Los Angeles. Can one really describe this as an accident? Just like when police accidentally shoot unarmed black men on a regular basis? Or when the Defense Department accidentally drone strikes a children's hospital? Or when the Treasury Department accidentally fails to safeguard incredibly sensitive financial and personal information on over 100,000 taxpayers? Or when the healthcare.gov accidentally enrolled thousands of people into the government's registry of sex offenders? Or when the Census Bureau accidentally funded a $2.6 million study on prostitutes in China? This is just typical American serial incompetence. It's not about individuals screwing up their jobs, but rather an entire system designed to fail. The Federal Reserve was founded 100 years ago to prevent banking panics, stabilize prices, and create stability in the financial system. Yet ever since the Fed took over control of the US economy, there has been an almost uninterrupted pattern of bubbles, busts, crises, and recessions. The Department of Energy was created on August the 4th, 1977, to reduce America's reliance on foreign oil drastically, which at that time was about 55% of US consumption. Yet after four decades and tens of billions of dollars spent annually, the US still relies on foreign sources for about 55% of its total oil needs, all according to data at the very department that's supposed to reduce it. The US Department of Education has spent billions since 1979 trying to improve education in America. Yet their own numbers show that reading scores have remained flat and that nearly 2 out of 3 children in the 8th grade still lack proficiency in both reading and math. This is total insanity. Literally. One dictionary defines insanity as extreme foolishness characterized by irrationality. Of course, my preferred definition of insanity is the old favourite about trying the same thing over and over again while expecting a different result. This is how government works. Whenever there are problems created by government, they simply create more government. We know perfectly well that this system doesn't work. We know that government bureaucracy is a joke, generally the butt of many jokes, which are funny because they're true. And yet, we allow ourselves to be deluded every 4 years by election hype. We allow ourselves to believe that the problems will go away, that this time will be different, if we just get the right person in office. People thought the same thing back in 2008 with Barack Obama and George W. Bush back in 2000. The excitement for the 2016 election is already palpable. People are fed up, but they believe that one of these candidates has the secret key to fixing everything in this giant accident we call government. Unfortunately, this is delusional thinking. And, yes, insanity. I'm sure most of them are very nice people and perhaps well-intended. But the problem is the system itself. awarding the power to regulate nearly every aspect of our lives to a bankrupt, centralized authority which churns out over 80,000 pages per year of new rules and laws. It's time to stop investing in this process and start investing in yourself. Because these people aren't going to fix anything. When your government has to spend more money on mandatory entitlement programs and interest on the debt than it collects in tax revenue, you might as well elect a banana to be the President of the United States. Nothing is going to happen by changing the players. You have to change the game. And sometimes that means walking away from the table. In a few days, we will be showing you how to do that in Penang. There's still time to sign up, by the way. All right, just a very quick heads up to see how the recovery is moving ahead. Corporate sales declined for the second quarter in a row and are now falling at a 3% rate. A record number of young people are living in their parents' homes. Yields for the lowest rated junk bonds have increased 50% in the last 12 months. Exports are falling. Durable goods orders are falling. And consumer spending is on the same downward slope it's been on since 1999. Any questions? All right, well, now, I want you to consider just a few market statistics, just to show you quickly and easily how crazy this speculative bubble has become. In inflation-adjusted terms, the S&P 500 index rose by 6.2% per annum over the last three decades. That compares to just a 2.2% annual advance for real GDP, meaning that the stock market has risen nearly three times faster than national output in real terms. First of all, and just take my word for this, the last three decades are utterly unique. If you run the clock backwards by 30 years from the January 1986 starting point, for instance, you get a totally different picture. Between the relatively sunny Eisenhower times of 1956 through the eve of Greenspan's ascension to the Fed, the S&P index rose by only 4.4 times. Not 10 times. Even more significantly, when you strip out the inflation, the real index rose by 1% per year, not 6.2%. The final comparison I want you to make is the real median family income growth between the two periods. During the 1956-86 interval, this basic measure of the Main Street standard of living rose from $36,000 to about $60,000, or 1.7% annually. Since then, not so much. Between the days when Birinyi was peddling stock charts at Salomon Brothers and the present, the real median family income has risen by less than $4,000, or by 0.2% per year. That is what you would call flat-out stagnation for 30 years. Between the days. Now, let's ask the obvious question. And no prizes for guessing what it is. If real GDP growth has decelerated so sharply, and if family incomes have stagnated so relentlessly during the last 30 years, why has the stock market been so continuously hyper-bullish? Enter stage left, the villain, dressed in black, with a pointy hat and grinning mischievously. Alan Greenspan at the Fed in August 1987. Something else started growing like gangbusters. To wit, the Fed balance sheet exploded by 22 times during the last 3 decades. That amounts to 11.5% per annum in nominal terms, 9.2% in real terms, and 4 times the growth rate of real output. What happened was that the Fed's relentless money printing caused a sweeping financialization of the US economy driven by a supernova of credit market debt. During the approximate span of the modern bull run credit market debt outstanding in the US, household businesses, financial and government has soared by $50 trillion. That compares to just a $13 trillion gain in GDP. Self-evidently, it doesn't take a spreadsheet to recognize that the nation's leverage ratio soared in lockstep with the upward-bounding stock market. In fact, the 2x leverage ratio of 1986 was already significantly elevated from the historic 1.5x leverage ratio that had prevailed for a century prior to Nixon's 1971 folly of destroying Bretton Woods at Camp David. But by the time of the financial crisis, it had soared to 3.5x since then, and it has retraced hardly at all. At that point, everybody got in on the act, buying and selling securities to each other and generally bidding up the price of assets accordingly. Needless to say, it was this mutually linked monetary and credit tsunami that enabled the massive financialization of the US economy and the 30-year bull run which it fostered. You see, in a world of honest money and credit funded from real savers, not central bank printing presses, of course, there is not a remote chance that China's exports could have risen by 40 times in less than 3 decades. That was 17% annually and is a rate of gain that cannot be sustained without systemic falsification of exchange rates and financial prices by the central banks. In a true free market, the China export machine would have run out of capital to build cheap factories and would have suffered soaring exchange rate increases long before the historical aberration depicted reached its current towering height. At the same time, America's $50 trillion uptake of new debt provided the financial fuel that funded a massive increase in stock market speculation and corporate financial engineering in the form of LBOs, stock buybacks, and incessant merger and acquisition deals. In a roundabout but unmistakable manner, the East Asian central bank printing presses recycled the Fed's monetary inflation back into domestic financial asset inflation. That is the true reason for the stock market's 30-year bull run. There has been a huge increase in the capitalization rate of national income, or the implied P/E ratio of the stock market. But that did not reflect a permanent improvement after 1986 in the productive efficiency or profitability of the US economy. In fact, measured productivity growth has been cut in half. And were real GDP not overstated, owing to ridiculously low price deflators, the true rate of productivity gain since the late 1980s would have registered at a mere fraction of its pre-1986 trends. No, the fact that the US stock market capitalization rose from 60% of GDP upon Greenspan's ascension to 200% today is purely a monetary effect. In practical terms, it reflects a giant ratchet upwards of leveraged speculation in the financial system. At the end of the day, that's what zero interest rate policy, quantitative easing, and the implicit Greenspan Bernanke yell put do. They fuel a cycle of debt-funded speculation that drives asset prices ever higher, which in turn become the collateral for an even bigger credit-funded bid for financial assets. Back in 1986, the financial sector, defined as the market value of equities plus credit market debt outstanding, was about $12 billion. Today, it is $93 trillion. Talk about the mother of all bubbles.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's wake-up call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Of the 9 recessions in the last 60 years, only 3 took longer than 6 years from the end of the previous one. It's been 6 years since the declared end of the Great Recession, and you would have to be willfully blind if you thought another one isn't coming down the pike sooner rather than later. Market fundamentals went AWOL a while back. Markets are carried by a few stocks and bolstered by Fed policy. Commodity prices are in decline. The strength of the dollar is on the rise because of global economic issues, which hurts exports. Not that the trade balance wasn't negative to begin with. The whole thing is a house of cards waiting to topple. On top of that, what happens when the next recession hits? The solution over the last 20 plus years has been for the Fed to lower rates to encourage borrowing. But rates are already at historic lows and have barely budged in 6 years. They want to raise rates, but they know they can't, and there is no way they can prevent another recession. What are they going to do? Go from zero interest rate policy to negative interest rate policy, as has already happened in some countries? The global economy has become over-leveraged, and in the end, math will win out, and there is nothing any central bank anywhere can do about it. I can almost guarantee that the next financial crisis will be the big one, and it will make the Great Recession seem like a Sunday picnic. Well, the latest employment figures did not help the market. While the unemployment rate remained unchanged, this has largely been driven by the massive number of Americans not in the labour force. This is the biggest employment story going on for a couple of years, but is completely ignored by the media. It is also conveniently ignored by the unemployment rate that only measures those in the labour force, which is a very generous range. A large part of the not in the labour force group has come from people simply being unable to find work in this low-wage economy. And then the media acts shocked that people like Trump and Bernie Sanders are gaining traction. The media would like to continue to paint a Pollyanna case of the economy, but that is just not the truth. We recently hit a record 93,770,000 Americans that are no longer in the labour force. 1 out of 3 Americans is not in the labour force, while 1 out of 3 workers is supporting the rest of the economy. Those not in the labour force have grown by a stunning 11 million in the last 5 years alone. Isn't this a recovery? Are we not in the middle of incredible growth and expansion? Well, that's obviously a question of how you define it, isn't it? The stock market is being juiced by easy monetary policy that is benefiting a small number of Americans, while technology stocks go up because of delusional venture capital money. It is all overhyped, and the spin machinery is getting overheated. We have added 11 million people to this category, a growth rate of 13.4%. In contrast, the US population has grown from 309 million to 321 million, a growth rate of 3.8%. So somehow, those not in the labour force are growing at a rate 3.5 times faster than population growth. You can see why there is something else going on here. One part is the millions in college going into massive amounts of debt. There is a large part of Americans in college, but how many will come out to good-paying jobs reflecting the debt they're taking on? Many do make it, but given the delinquency rates in student debt, many have a college degree and are essentially thrown into the low-wage segment of the economy. Simply having an educated population isn't sufficient for good job growth. Look at Spain and Greece with their massive youth unemployment. The unemployment rate looks low as well because of eliminating a lot of people that should be counted. How many of those not in the labour force have given up looking for work? How many are camping out in college? You also have many older Americans being unable to compete in the labour force and now are simply relying on their tiny social security payments to survive and avoid being in poverty. People find it hard to believe, but half of social security recipients would be out in the street and homeless if it were not for the monthly payment they receive. There is definitely something fishy going on with the growth in this category of employment. How is it feasible to be growing at a rate 3.5 times that of the population? In the end, the spin machinery will continue to go on trying to juice the stock markets higher, despite none of the gains flowing down to your working class American. Well, the odds weren't in Walter L. Scott's favour. Reportedly pulled over for a broken taillight, Scott, unarmed, ran away from the police officer, who pursued and shot him from behind, first with a taser, then with a gun. Scott was struck 5 times, 3 times in the back, once in the upper buttocks, and once in the ear, with at least one bullet entering his heart. Samuel Dubose, also unarmed, was pulled over for a missing front license plate. He was reportedly shot in the head after a brief struggle in which his car began rolling forward. Levi Jones was stopped for a seatbelt offence just as he was getting out of his car to enter a convenience store. Directed to show his license, Jones leaned into his car to get his wallet, only to be shot 4 times by the fearful officer. Jones was also unarmed. Bobby Knipe was pulled over for having an expired registration. When the 70-year-old reached into the back of his truck for his walking cane, the officer fired several shots at him, hitting him once in the abdomen. Dontrell Stevens was stopped, quote-unquote, for not bicycling properly. The officer pursuing him, quote-unquote, thought the way Stevens rode his bike was suspicious. He thought the way Stevens got off his bike was suspicious. 4 seconds later, Sheriff's Deputy Adams Lynn shot Stevens 4 times as he pulled out a black object from his waistband. The object was his cell phone. Stevens was unarmed. According to the Justice Department, the most common reason for a citizen to come out into contact with the police is being a driver in a traffic stop. Black drivers are 31% more likely to be pulled over than white drivers, or about 23% more likely than Hispanic drivers. As Sandra Bland learnt the hard way, the reason for a traffic stop no longer matters. Bland, who was pulled over for allegedly failing to use her turn signal, was arrested after refusing to comply with the police officer's order to extinguish her cigarette and exit her vehicle. The encounter escalated, with the officer threatening to light Bland up with his taser. 3 days later, Bland was found dead in her jail cell. Incredibly, a federal appeals court actually ruled unanimously in 2014 that acne scars and driving with a stiff upright posture are reasonable grounds for being pulled over. More recently, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that driving a vehicle that has a couple of air fresheners, rosaries, and pro-police bumper stickers at 2 miles an hour over the speed limit is suspicious, meriting a traffic stop. So if you don't want to get probed, poked, pinched, tasered, tackled, searched, seized, stripped, manhandled, arrested, shot, or killed, don't say, do, or even suggest anything that even hints of non-compliance when it comes to interactions with police. One police officer advised that if you feel as if you're being treated unfairly, comply anyhow and contest it in court later. Pretty good advice, I would say, ladies and gentlemen. Did you know that no democracy has survived beyond 235 years? Virtually all democracies have collapsed once they suffer from physical and moral bankruptcy. Alexander Tyler once noted that the average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been about 200 years. He also said, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, followed by a dictatorship. The problem is, we the people have given away everything to the elect few who have literally destroyed the United States. The people have only themselves to blame." Well, I thought I'd fill you in on what happens to so-called bailout money that is supposed to benefit Greece, and indeed what all the present fuss is all about. Let's just have a quick look and see where it all goes and how it gets there. "Bailout money goes to Greece only to flow out again," is the title of a recent article in the New York Times. Unfortunately, this is a feature of bailout, not a bug. A whole host of financial rescues during the past decades has proven quite convincingly that this isn't an aberration. Follow the money instead of following the headlines. That's how you learn who profits from a bailout. Look round the world. Japan, Sweden, Brazil, Mexico, Ireland, the US, and now Greece to learn who is and isn't helped by these enormous government-backed bailouts. No, it isn't the Greek people, nor even their banks. They never were the intended beneficiaries of the bailouts, nor were the Irish citizens in their bailout. Indeed, homeowners in the US were little more than incidental recipients of aid as a percentage of total rescue spending. You probably learnt the phrase moral hazard during the financial crisis. In short, what it means is that the bailouts rescued leveraged, reckless speculators from the results of their unwise professional folly and gave them an incentive to do it all over again. They were always the intended rescuees. In case you think I'm exaggerating, consider the US bailout in its many forms, from TARP to ZERP to QE. How many bondholders suffered losses from their poor investment decisions? With the exception of the holders of Lehman Brothers' debt and a handful of banks that weren't deemed too big to fail, just about every other bondholder was made whole. 100 cents on the dollar. Thanks to rescue plans such as the Troubled Asset Relief Program, holders of bonds from a diverse assortment of failed and failing companies suffered literally no losses. American International Group? Zero losses. Government-sponsored entities Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Zero losses. Banking giants Citigroup and Bank of America? Zero losses. Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns? Zero losses. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's actions were rare exceptions to this rule. Its bailouts actually benefited customers, savings and checking account holders. When banks such as IndyMac, Wachovia, Washington Mutual went belly up, the FDIC arranged shotgun marriages. WaMu went to JP Morgan Chase, Wachovia went to Wells Fargo, IndyMac went to One West Bank. Once it was certain the account holders were made whole, whatever assets were left went to the most senior creditors, typically bondholders. Equity holders usually get wiped out. In Washington Mutual's case, bond owners received between 20 and 28 cents on the dollar. Other FDIC resolutions yielded similar amounts. Even the Federal Reserve's zero interest rate policy, in place for so long that there hasn't been a rate increase in more than 9 years, is there to help rescued banks. For years after the financial crisis, their bank sheets remained festooned with so many bank mortgages and soured loans that an early increase in rates would have put those portfolios at huge risk. Now that prices have mostly returned to pre-crisis levels, it is considered safe to increase the Fed funds rates, which we all know will have a significant impact on mortgage rates. With foreclosures down tremendously from their peak, the banks can tolerate interest increases. Despite plenty of evidence that the economy could have absorbed interest rate increases almost 2 years ago, the economy met the Fed's own parameters at that time. Bank mortgage portfolios were still shaky and not in shape to deal with rate increases. More losses that could have compromised the banking industry's health were likely. So if you think that it's just a coincidence that rates are likely to rise only now when bank balance sheets can tolerate them, you haven't been paying close attention. History teaches us that when companies fail, they file either a reorganization or liquidation in a bankruptcy court. The exceptions are when well-paced executives are friendly with Congress, such as Chrysler in 1980, or members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lockheed in 1972, or Treasury Secretaries, all of Wall Street except Dick Fuld in 2008-9. Having well-connected corporate executives on your board or in senior management sure comes in handy during an emergency. Which brings us back to Greece. Its leaders never learnt the lesson that Ireland eventually figured out and tiny Iceland understood from the start. The phrase systemic risk is nothing more than code. What it actually means is that a politically connected banker wants the government to cover losses on bad investments. In the case of Greece, the money flows in large part from European governments and the International Monetary Fund through Greece and then to various private sector lenders. We all call it a Greek bailout, because if it were called the rescue of German bankers from the results of their Athenian lending folly, who would support it? Our moral compass informs us that bailouts shouldn't work to the benefit of the reckless and irresponsible. Reality teaches us a very different lesson. Right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it, the end of our show, and one more week, if I understand correctly, to make that fateful decision to come to Penang and learn what it's like to live in a foreign country. We've got lots and lots of good things for you. Let's see you, and for those who are signed up, can't wait to see you all. And in the meantime, this is Richard Martin wishing you all the best for the weekend. Have a wonderful summer repose, and I'll be back with you bright and early on Monday. Take care. Until then, bye-bye.
And there you have it. You decide.